Pour cette première leçon inaugurale, notre invité est le professeur Carlo Ratti, qui vient du MIT. Il va faire sa conférence en anglais et je vais passer en anglais pour faire la présentation. Tout le monde ici parle anglais et tout à l'heure, dans la période des questions, les questions pourront être en anglais et pourront aussi être en français, même si le débat se poursuivra sans doute en anglais. So this morning, we have the great honor and pleasure to welcome Professor Carlo Ratti with a leading voice in the debate on new technologies' impact on urban life. Carlo Ratti, you are an engineer and an architect, trained in Politecnico di Milano and also in École des Ponts, and in University of Cambridge. You are a researcher and a professor in the Massachusetts Institute of Technology in Boston. You are the director of the Sensible City Lab, which you created in MIT more than 10 years ago. And you also founded an international design and innovation office, Carlo Ratti Associati, which is based in Torino, and you launched many startups. Both your scientific work and your innovations in the fields of architecture, design, are extremely impressive. Your work has been presented in several international events, and two of your projects have been hailed as best inventions of the year by Time magazine. Through the research projects of the Sensible City Lab, your inaugural lecture will show how the increasing development of sensors on handheld electronics in recent years is allowing a new approach to the study of the cities. Professor Ratti, I thank you very much for accepting this invitation at École des Ponts, and I give you the floor without further delay.
Thank you. Thank you very much. And first of all, good morning, everybody. It's a great pleasure to be here. And it feels a little bit like going back home. As it was mentioned before, I graduated before initially from Politecnico of Torino, not Milan. That's like, you know, messing up École des Mines, École des Ponts, or something like that. So then I came to Paris at the École des Ponts. Then went to Cambridge and ended up at MIT. Now, what we do today, and what I'll show you today, is what we are doing in with different things, with different units, and I'll show you in a moment, but est-ce qu'on peut baisser un peu la lumière? Okay, so what we are doing today, we're doing with basically three different things. One is MIT, Sensible City Lab. It's a research group. It's called, it's at MIT, and it's both in Cambridge, Massachusetts, but also at MIT in Singapore. MIT has a research unit in Singapore, so we're between the two. Most of the people, 40 people in Singapore, in Boston, but a few people in Singapore as well. And then there's our design office. Our design office is based in Italy, New York, small office in London. And then we got some startups that came out over the past few years. And our passion, or what we really like to study, is this. And when you look at this, this is Paris, actually, is a city. But I like to study cities in general. You know, cities didn't exist once upon a time. We didn't have cities 10,000 years ago. And then humanity discovers this amazing way in order to bring us together and to make sure in a city that we can exchange ideas, we can meet up, we can exchange chromosomes. We can make sure that the total is more than the sum of the individual parts. Now, the amazing thing, if you think about cities, four numbers. Just remember those four numbers, 2, 50, 75, 80. Cities are only 2% of the crust of the planet, but they're 50%, a little bit over 50% of the population now. They are 75% of energy consumption, and they are 80% of CO2 emissions. So actually, if we can do something to make our cities more sustainable, the impact at the global scale can be quite large. Now, if you look at a city like this, usually we've been studying cities like, you know, something static. For thousands of years, we've been looking at cities through mapping, through static mapping, by looking at bricks, about the physical part of cities. But today we can start looking at cities in a more dynamic way, in a similar way to what happened with Etienne Jules Marais, when over 100 years ago he started looking at movement, human movement, looking at new tools in order to understand not only the static component of life, but the dynamic one. Well, today we can do the same thing when we look at a city. And we can do that because over the past few years, something quite interesting has happened. And what has happened is that the internet, that changed our lives over the past 10, 20, 30 years, is entering physical space. If you want, is digital and physical coming together? Is internet becoming Internet of Things? And hence allowing us a new way to understand and to transform a city. For instance, we can understand a city like this. That's a visualization of Lisbon. We had it at MoMA, the Museum of Modern Art in New York. It was done by Pedro Cruz from our lab at MIT. And we couldn't see a city just, say, 20 years ago. But we can today. That's a city capture using billions and billions of data points collected from the taxis. Actually, I wanted to start today with one of the oldest projects we ever did. And this is a project we did back in 2006, so over 10 years ago. Really one of the first projects where, for the first time, we looked at data from many, many people collected through cell phone in order to map a city in real time in a dynamic way. In the time, it hadn't been done yet. So we did this. We were collecting the data in Italy for millions of people, anonymized and aggregated. We were showing the data at the Venice Biennale. You see here our pavilion. What we were doing was, you know, get all the data from, especially from the cell phone network, but also from taxis and so on, send it, ship it to MIT in real time, analyze big data, all this big data, use algorithms to understand what was going on, visualize it, and send it back to the Venice Biennale. If any of you is interested, there's a few papers about this. You find them online on Google Scholar, so you can actually look at that, some of the maths behind and so on. It's interesting that actually even today when you look at you know, the traffic jams on Google Maps, a lot of that comes from some of the initial ideas and papers and patents developed at the time about, you know, looking at all this data from mobile phones and how they can tell us something about the space we live in. Now, I wanted to share with you something quite interesting that we recorded this summer. You know, we were collecting data every day for months and months. And that was summer 2006 when something interesting happened. And that's actually when there was a soccer World Cup. Now, some of you might be too young to remember, but the soccer World Cup was actually Italy and France playing in the final. Well, Italy won at the time. And look at what happened in the city of Rome by actually looking at all the cell phone movement during the final of the World Cup. So what you see here is the final, is before the match. You got people moving in the city, here and there, going shopping. You see, that's the early afternoon, what you see at the top. And then, you know, still before the match, you see the Colosseum, the river. Then the match begins, silence. Nobody talks anymore. France scores, Italy scores, halftime. People make a call and go to the bathroom. Second half, end of normal time, first overtime, second overtime, the famous headbutt by Zidane, and finally, Italy wins. Sorry, guys. So that night, everybody goes to celebrate here in the city center. The following day, again, the winning team, you know, the finals were in Germany, so the winning team goes to Rome, and you know, they go here to celebrate with the prime minister and so on, and by the end of the day, everybody went down here to a place called Circo Massimo, which is a place where since Roman times, people actually go and celebrate. You see a big peak there by the end of the day. So, you know, how we can understand the city as something dynamic in a way that we couldn't before. Sorry, I... Now, let me give you another example about this type of data about mobility in the city and how we can analyze it. What you see here is another type of data, but same type of thing. It's about digital data collected from human movement in the city. And what you see here is actually taxis. Every yellow dot is a pickup. Somebody gets into taxi. And the blue dot is a drop-off. Somebody gets off a taxi. What you see here is New York, is JFK Airport. If you've landed at JFK, you were at one of the airports here. You may be one of the dots over there. If you zoom out, you see here, you see JFK, Manhattan, and all of the boroughs. And then you can ask yourself, you know, well, what if people were ready to share mobility more? We know that today we like to share many things. We like to share apartments on Airbnb, couches on couch surfing platforms. So what if we could share mobility more? Now, if you look at 2 points in Manhattan, random 2 points, you got hundreds of thousands of trips connecting them in the course of the day. So how many of those trips could actually be shared by different people? Now, if you want to solve that question, to answer that question, you cannot do with traditional mathematics. Sometimes we say, you know, big data also need big maths or new maths in order to address it. The traditional way to look at this is linear programming, but linear programming fails when you got so much data to analyze. So what we did here, again, if you're interested, that's a PNAS paper on it a couple of years ago. We used network science to try to solve the question. And the way we phrased the question was, imagine in New York you want to take everybody to destination when they need to be there, give or take a couple of minutes, a small delta of delay, but that you limit to very little, then what is the minimum minimum number of vehicles that you need? What you do, you develop these shareability networks. You know, if you increase the delta, you can share more trips, so the networks densify. And what you find is quite extraordinary is that actually in New York, you could actually cut 40% of the taxis and still take everybody to destination when they need to be there with a delay which is less than 3 minutes. Now, two interesting things happen with this. The first thing that happened is that the paper is from a couple of years ago. The first results came out earlier, and they came to the attention of Uber. And so since then, we started a large collaboration with Uber, and as you might know, UberPool does exactly that. Allows, you know, two people to go more or less in the same direction, to share the trip, and hence, you know, you pay more, you take one car out of the road, and you reduce congestion, and so on. The other interesting thing is that when the results were published, the New York Times reviewed them and did a very interesting article where they say, you know, well, this is interesting mathematics, but you know what? No New Yorker would want to share anything else with anybody else, let alone another New Yorker, let alone sharing a car. Well, it turns out that was not the case. It turns out that sharing with UberPool, we are working with them with all their data, has been a huge success. You know, and every time you allow to share a trip, again, you know, it means you reduce congestion, pollution, energy consumption, and many other different things. I'll tell you another time about something that our students now are passionate about, which is combining this with Tinder and Grindr, but that's another story. What can you do then with this, you know, in a more general sense? Well, this was about New York, so the question you could ask is, New York has a huge density of taxis. Would this apply all over the world? That's a paper from Nature Scientific Reports, I think last year. We actually started looking at cities all over the world, and you find that, yes, actually the same thing applies all over the world. We can actually find some general common law of ride sharing, and that's what actually makes sure that you can use UberPool. You know, Paris was one of the first. UberPool started in San Francisco, then I think in New York. Paris was one of the top five cities at the beginning, and now is spreading all across the planet. Now, that's about just using data in order to better understand the city, and in this case, perhaps also think about different ways to move in the city. But we can do other things. And the reason is that our cars are becoming more like this. Our cars are being covered with sensing systems. What you see here is around 2,000, 3,000 sensors that are contained in every car you drive today. And if you take all these sensors, you can know a lot of things about the driver, about the city, and so on. But also tomorrow, you can just add a couple of more sensors like this, or a few more cameras and two little ears. The two little ears are two LiDAR systems. The LiDAR, what it does a three-dimensional scan of the city. Then you take all of this, you feed it into an AI system, into an artificial intelligence system. You can use different type of techniques, and then the car drives itself. Now, this is not the future. This is the present. Again, this is Uber testing them on the road. We've been working with the government in Singapore in order to do the first deployment this year of self-driving car in Singapore. I think Singapore is the city today with the largest number of self-driving cars being tested on a regular basis. And when you got a system like this, it's interesting because the point is not only that you don't need to keep your hands on the steering wheel, but the point is that your car can give you a lift in the morning when you go to your office, and then can give a lift to somebody else in your family or to anybody else in the city. So what you're doing, you're creating a system in between public and private transportation. Now, if you combine this about sharing the vehicle itself, what I was saying before, the sharing of the ride, that gives you a city where theoretically you could actually take everybody to destination, but theoretically with just a fraction of the cars we have today, something between 20 and 30%. Now, I'm not saying that this is going to happen, will depend on many other things, but I think theoretically what you get, that's the kind of lower bound you get. Now, the other interesting thing is that when everything will be self-driving, this is going to happen now, as soon as self-driving cars are going to hit the road, But when everything is going to be self-driving, other things might happen. For instance, this might change. You're all familiar with this. It's a well-known traffic light. And traffic lights arrived on our road when actually cars arrived on our roads. But if you've got an intelligent system where every car knows where it is, it knows where all the other cars are, then you can keep on going, just avoiding to bump into another car. A little bit like this. Don't try it yet. I gave a presentation some time ago in Naples, and they told me, so what is new here? As you might know, I'm Italian, I can say it, but this is a former Italian ministry. In Milan, traffic lights are instructions. In Rome, there are suggestions. In Naples, there are Christmas decorations. Again, if you're interested in this, you can. This is one of the articles that talks about the mathematics. It's interesting. It was done by the leading author on this paper is a French guy from Rue d'Ulm, who has been in our lab for a few years, and it's actually taking queuing theory and expanding queuing theory so you can actually apply to a problem like this one. You know, the intersection seems very simple, but you've got different frequencies of arrival. You've got different type of trajectories connecting the different roads. So when you combine all of that, it can become quite interesting mathematically. And what I want to share with you is here, for instance. What you see to the left and to the right is the same intersection in Singapore, the same number of vehicles to the left and to the right. But actually, to the left, they are managed using the most intelligent traffic light system we have today. And to the right, they're managed using a slot-based system, similar to what we have in airports. And if you look at this, same number of cars, but look at the difference to the left, you know, in terms of delay per car and cars waiting, and to the right, just by changing the way you're managing intersection. And you know, the interesting thing is that when you look at the city, usually the intersection is the bottleneck. The intersection, you've got two competing flows fighting for the same real estate. So if you can fix the intersection, then you've got a system that, you know, can fix automatically most of the things happening on the network. That's a bottleneck for an urban traffic network. So you know, there's something about looking at autonomous mobility, but let's look at other things. And a couple of years ago, we started talking to the city of Amsterdam. Amsterdam, as you know, is a beautiful city. It's an amazing city. And we met a few times with the mayor. The mayor is very excited about new technologies. And we started thinking about, well, how can autonomy be used in Amsterdam? Now, you've got a problem if you look at the center of Amsterdam is that you don't have that many roads. You've got a lot of canals, but not roads. So we started thinking about, you know, well, could we look at self-driving boats? We call them rowboats. So if you take a rowboat, what can you do with that? What you can do? Well, you can do what people do today with boats. You can use it for moving freight, parcels, like the DHL boat in Amsterdam. You can use it for moving people. You can use it for other things, for sensing the water. It's quite easy to think about how this could become like a floating platform to sense the city. But you can also use it like, you know, almost like a dynamic architecture platform, something that, you know, when you need a bridge in real time to connect two parts of a canal, you know, all the different boats, like pixels, floating pixels, can come and create a connection. Or if you need a floating stage for a concert, or if you've got an emergency in the city. And they just come together, self-assemble, and help you to create a dynamic, responsive architecture in the city. And of course, that's not new. That's what we've seen done for a long time. That's actually Venice during the Festa del Redentore. You've got all the gondolas coming together and creating a temporary bridge. You know, I think that's the nice thing about technology, and hopefully we'll be able to discuss it later with Antoine Picon in the conversation that we'll have after this presentation, is about, you know, technology sometimes is just a new way to do what we always wanted to do, or to do what we wanted to do in a different way or in a better way. It's not about creating new needs, but it's actually about finding new ways to look at important things, the things that are dear to us. And as humans, those things often have been there for a very, very long time. So we started the project less than a year ago. What you see here is the first test we've been doing. As you all know, drones have been very, very successful all over the world. And the reason is that you just have four motors. You control them, very easy to control. And with four motors, you become very flexible. So we started thinking, can we do like a boat that works like a drone, four different motors? We tried to put it like this way, you know, 90 degrees, or we try to put jets like this, water jets, four water jets. That's the first scale model we did. It's around 1 to 4, so it's much smaller than the final one. You see here the first test in the canals in Amsterdam. You see how flexible, how controllable it is, the four jets. This was just a few months ago. It can also move laterally. You know, in the worst case, we're going to open a toy company because everybody seems to have so much fun playing with this. We're also working with drones in different ways. You know, I don't think personally we'll use a lot of drones to move heavy weights in the city. Just physics is against it. If you just do the very simple physics of the helicopter, you know, it uses so much energy just to keep some weight up in midair. And then, you know, you use so much energy and just because of simple physics, and you generate an immense amount of noise. So I don't think we'll see our cities filled with very big drones to move people around. But we can use drones for little things like this. That's another project we're working on. We're using drones for doing graffiti. You know, you've got four drones with four different colors. You can turn every part of the city. You can open this up to citizens in an open source way. It becomes like a platform for changing this. Incidentally, I'm combining together projects from our design office and from our lab. You know, the mathematical, the research side is from the lab, and this side is more from the design office. I also want to share with you a project that had a different, again, with mobility. We're all looking at different ways to tackle mobility. And this had a different story. It started when the mayor of Copenhagen came to us and started, you know, talking to us about how we could address some mobility issues in Copenhagen. Now, the very interesting thing in Copenhagen is that mobility issues look like this. Copenhagen is a city where between 30 to 50% of all trips every day actually happen by bicycle. So we started thinking about bicycles, and we came up with the idea, well, can we actually try to insert electronics in a bike in order to make it like a super bike? And why would you want to do that? Well, because in the 20th century, our cities have become much bigger. You know, our cities were designed for bikes. In the 20th century, our cities have become much bigger. And then the way we can actually now cope with the cities is if we make also our bikes stronger. If you live in Beijing, imagine if you live in Wangfujing, in the center of Beijing, and you just want to go north, think about next to the Olympic Stadium, not really far, but then it's 20 kilometers. Now, you cannot do that with a normal bike, 20 kilometers in the morning, 20 kilometers in the evening. You can do it a few times, but not every day. But you can do it if you've got an e-bike, something that multiplies your torque. So our idea was, can we actually do this in a way that it can actually all fit inside the bicycle wheel? Can we make a smart robotic wheel that you just put on every bike and turns your bike into this bike? This is something we did at MIT. Again, if you're interested in the detail, there's, you know, this is the MIT patent that was filed at the time. This led to this project that you see here in the video.
This is the Copenhagen Wheel. It turns your ordinary bicycle into a smart electric hybrid by simply replacing your back wheel. Connect it to your smartphone, download the app, and you're ready to go. Bicycles are a great way to move around, yet sometimes distances are too long, hills can get in the way, and hard journeys to work may leave you covered in sweat. The Copenhagen Wheel is here to change all of that. The technology was developed over several years at MIT, together with the city of Copenhagen, one of the world's most innovative places for cycling. Its original inventors licensed the technology and founded Super Pedestrian, the startup where we are now working around the clock to bring the wheel to you. Like the best riding companion, the Copenhagen Wheel learns how you pedal and integrates seamlessly with your motion. It captures your energy when you brake or go downhill, and gives you a push when you need it, with 3 to 10 times your regular foot power. It's easy. Ride it just like a normal bike. As you pedal, the motor automatically kicks in, with no additional throttles or buttons. All technology for the Copenhagen Wheel is contained within the red casing, including motor, removable batteries, wireless connectivity, smart locking, multiple sensors, and an embedded control system. Use your smartphone to customize your ride, monitor your physical activity, gather information from your environment to share with your friends and fellow cyclists. And if you're a software developer, you can even create your own biking apps. So whether you carry yourself, your kids, or your gear, hills seem flat, distances shrink, and you can cycle just about anywhere. So transform your bike and transform the city. The Copenhagen Wheel.
The reason I showed this project is because I had a kind of a different lineage, and this was the first startup we created around 4 years ago. It's called Super Pedestrian. We raised around $50 million of venture capital money. I think I want to share with you, and we'll talk about this in the end. I think there's a great opportunity for all of you doing engineering and looking at a new way to get out of the school and do some of the amazing things in the startup world. And Xavier Niel was one of the people who invested in our startup, out of many other people. As you know, Xavier Niel is doing a lot of initiatives here in Paris with the Alfred Siné and many other, his accelerator and Ecole 42. And I think there's something very interesting we can discuss later in the conversation also with Antoine and with all of you. But I want to share with you just a little story that's a very common story at MIT. This company has grown a lot in a few years. Next year it might be a unicorn, might go to zero, we don't know. They can take a lot of risk, but it's also fun, and it's more about to look at how to transform things in the cities we live in. That's the page of the Copenhagen Wheel. I want to finish with a couple of more projects that deal with mobility in a different way. This is about mobility of goods. It's a project we did with the World Expo in Milan. The World Expo was 2010 was Shanghai, 2015 was Milan, 2020 will be Dubai. And so we've been working with the different expo now for a few years. And in Milan, we were fortunate enough to do two pavilions. One of the two pavilions was this part that was called the Future Food District. Now, every expo is the international exhibition. There's pavilions by countries. It was a beautiful French pavilion in Milan, pavilions from all over the world. But then you got four or five main thematic pavilions. And in every expo, usually a pavilion about the future, and so we were given this brief. We did not design the box, so the box was given to us, so no responsibility for the architecture of that, but actually we could fill in with anything we wanted in this case. And the theme they gave us was, first of all, to look at the future, but Milan, the expo in Milan, if any of you has been, was about feeding the planet, so about products, about agricultural production, about selling products, about food in general and transforming and eating food. And so in this case, it told us, can you do this in this pavilion? Can we do something like there's a brief we were given, like a supermarket of the future? So how could the distribution of products be tomorrow? Now, we knew what we did not want to do. We didn't want to do this. There's a beautiful picture by Andreas Gursky, a great photographer, but it's an alienating picture, the supermarket of the 20th century. What we liked was this quote by Italo Calvino. Italo Calvino is an Italian writer, and he has a character called Mr. Palomar. Mr. Palomar is this character who's a little bit aloof and provincial, and one day Mr. Palomar comes to Paris, and goes into a fromagerie, and then says, looking and thinking about all the stories behind the piece of cheese. And little by little, the fromagerie becomes, for him, like the Louvre. Calvino says, the shop is a museum. Mr. Palomar, visiting it, feels as he does in the Louvre. Behind every displayed object, the presence of the civilization has given it form and takes form from it. Now, and of course, this idea that products can tell us their stories is not new. Many people have tried to bring this into the supermarket. When you look at this is Tesco, a big supermarket chain from the UK, but active all over the world. This was Seoul, Korea. It was in the subway. You see this guy is entering inside the RER in Seoul. And the idea was you take your phone, you take a picture of the thing, you scan it, you learn about the product, so you get all the stories about the products, and then you can decide to buy it. But again, if you look at this, it's kind of alienating. It's no surprise this lasted for a few months and then was shut down. Our idea was different. We said, can we actually use technology to bring this back to life? And if you look at this is a traditional market. And look at the richness of interaction between people and people, or people and products, or people and people through products that you have in a traditional market. So the way we tried to do it was by putting everything on tables. A table is a beautiful interface. As humans, we've been using tables for thousands of years to eat together, to sell things, to share things, to have a conversation. They put everything on table, and on the top of the table, we put a lot of Kinect. As you might know, the Kinect sensor is what you use with the Xbox by Microsoft. It does a simplified 3D scan of your body. So if you've got a Kinect here, you can actually see a three-dimensional scan similar to the one we saw with LiDAR in the car before, but much faster and, you know, much more low res. And then based on that, then you know what people were touching and engaging with, and so you could actually use this information as a way to seamlessly give information, the stories of products to people. The idea was if you got an apple, you can buy the apple in 1 second like this, and then if you got 3 seconds, you might learn a little bit more about that apple, where it's coming from, and so on. If you got 10 seconds, maybe you can see a video of the orchard where the apple was produced. Now, we did a whole pavilion a bit like a theater, so we liked the idea that one could see all the products from the beginning, so you would enter from here, from down here, you would see actually the underbelly, the warehouse, you go up, and then you would see all the different products, and then from the top, you would actually have this view, so all of them would come together with the idea that you would get the products, the digital information on products, and then at the top, also aggregated information about people. You know, with products, there's something which is similar to Newton's law. There's always some kind of reciprocity. In this case, you know, you're giving information to people, but for doing that, you're also collecting information about people. So you know what people click on, which is what happens already online. Every time you go on Amazon or online, you know, all the clicks are monitored. But in this case, the clicks go from online to the physical space. So this was the Bill Supermarket. It won a number of design awards and was one of the most visited pavilions at the expo. You see here the different tables with the products. Here you see the different layers of information. So you see the products, the physical layer, and then the different digital layers at the end, like a real-time visualization of all what's happening in the supermarket. It's quite an interesting thing, the supermarket, this kind of aggregator, collecting stuff from all over the world into its belly and then distributing it again. In this case, all over the world to people at the expo. This was both a pavilion and the real supermarket, perhaps, and it wasn't clear. Here we see people actually touching the different products and getting and discovering information about it. And then your information, if you just play for a few seconds, you get this, like nutritional values or carbon footprint. But then the more you engage with it, actually, the more you discover. Now, I'll show you now two very short videos that gives you a sense of the experience inside. It's a short teaser we did. Here's a video that actually goes a bit more in detail into the project.
Designed by Carlo Ratti-Sorchatti for Expo Milano, the Future Food District is a thematic area that explores the impact of digital technologies on the production chain. A lab and living museum where people can experience a new way to shop. The Future Food District overturns the traditional supermarket layout. Products are organized on large tables. Like a traditional market, the horizontal landscape becomes a floor for conversation. The buying space becomes the meeting place once more. Every product has a story to tell. Through a simple hand gesture, products reveal augmented information about their stories, properties, and paths. This in turn promotes more conscious consumption patterns, fostering new modes of exchange between users and sellers. Through the use of technology, we can achieve a new level of connection between people and food, a more ethical and transparent production chain. The integration of advanced automation technologies generate unexpected synergies. Yumi, the world's first truly collaborative dual-arm robot, was unveiled at the supermarket. Future Food District forecasts a possible future scenario where technology can help us reconnect with the production chain, changing our relationship with food and with our fellow citizens.
So, in this case, the story of how this center, you know, all these projects are like research or prototypes, but then some of them go into the real world. In this case, the story was a bit different. That's the first supermarket in the world that uses the same technology. Expo finished like a year and a half ago. But then also this led to a patent, and that is now being a bit licensed by a number of chains. So I think our office is working with Carrefour, with Target, with different supermarket chains all over the world. And here you see the first one was built using the same technology. And so this was about mobility of products, as you know, products come together, and then we buy them. And I want to finish with a project that actually looks at what happens when we throw things away, products away. And this project started a few years ago when we started looking at this computer. If you look at this computer, you know everything about it. Today, you know every chip, where it was produced, how it moved on the planet, how it became this machine. But then a few years from now, you stop using this computer, you sell it, at some point somebody will throw it away, and then you know nothing about it. At that point, you know, sometimes this is what happens. A lot of e-waste shipped illegally from the United States to Asia, from Europe to Africa, sometimes, you know, ending up where it shouldn't. So our idea was, what if you could develop a little chip and put it on trash, on waste, and then follow waste? So we understand what goes to the right place, to the wrong place, how we can, you know, make the whole waste removal process more seamless and efficient. Again, if you're interested, there's a few scientific papers that tell the story about, you know, about the tags, how we made them. Designing the tag was a bit like designing a miniature cell phone. You want to do like a cell phone that lasts for a long time, for many months. But then it only has to do one action, perform one action, which is get location and send it back. So you need to re-engineer it so it can last for a long time, be very resilient, and just do the simple action. This was the first deployment we did in Seattle. We had 500 volunteers came with 3,000 pieces of trash. We put a little tag on all of them. And after tagging all of them, we started following them. So here you see 3,000 objects. The day of deployment. After a few days, you see some of the main landfills next to Seattle. But actually, a big surprise, how far some of the traces went. Sometimes in crazy ways, look at the trace. They went all the way to Chicago, changed its mind, and went back to California. And still moving after 1 month or 2 months. So what can you do with this? First thing you can do, you get all this data, you do big data analytics, and you try to optimize not the supply chain. We've done that over the past few decades, optimizing the supply chain, but you can look at this and optimize the removal chain. What happens to things when we throw them away? Second thing that's very, very important is that if you take data, if you share data with people, then just by sharing, you actually can generate a lot of behavioral change. You can have an impact just by sharing this information. And actually, again, there's a paper, if you want, online, where we actually try to quantify the impact of this. But the idea is very simple, is that, you know, basically you know more about the consequences of what you do, and then you might change your behavior. Just an anecdote, somebody came to us at the end of the project and said, look, I used to drink water in plastic bottles every day and then throw them away and forget about them. But now, after the project, I know that those bottles go a few miles from home to a landfill. They will stay there forever. So stop drinking water in plastic bottles. So this idea that big data really tells much more about us, about the environment, and then we can use this information to change how we do things. The third thing is that while we were doing the project, we actually discovered that a lot of pieces of waste would end up at the border of the United States and then would disappear. We couldn't track them anymore. And then, so over the past couple of years, perhaps even more, but we presented this last year, but over the past few years, we've been actually looking at the global tracking of e-waste, not just in the United States, but globally. We discovered places such as this one, in the jungle in the middle of Asia. And so the idea, again, you know, is that you take all the tags, here is all electronics in the United States, you tag all them, you follow them worldwide. You can, if you go on the site, by the way, incidentally, you can look at all the traces, you can click on them, see what they were, where they went. Some of those are legal, some of those are illegal. If you're interested, there's also a special by PBS, the TV channel in the United States, that looked at, followed some of the traces. But again, the idea that big data also tells us more about what happens on our planet. And if we use big data in the right way, then we can understand global flows, and then when there's an issue, such as this one, we can then try to take action. The last thing we discovered is something that was totally unexpected. And that happened when a burglar came to our offices at MIT. And this poor guy stole a lot of things. including tags and computers that tell you where they go. And this is what happened. I just want to share with you some concluding and parting thoughts very quickly. The first one is, you know, we used to think that knowledge was actually something like this. We used to think that everything could actually be fit into the right spot. That was St. Thomas' idea. When St. Thomas wrote the Summa a few centuries ago, what he tries to do is to combine all of human knowledge and systematize and put everything in the right spot. Well, you know now that that's not the case anymore. We cannot do that. If you had to think about a map of human knowledge, perhaps it looks more like this. It's actually a map that was on the cover of Nature magazine, Nature, the journal. If you look at this, this was made using taking 800,000 papers and looking at all the links between the papers. The links are one scientific paper actually referring to another scientific paper. Is, you know, one paper connecting with another paper. And if you look at this, you see that everything is connected with everything else. You see beautiful links appearing between brain research and computer science and mathematics and mental health. So you see something, you know, that idea of discipline separation is breaking down. Actually, Nature did some additional studies on this and, for instance, looked at the most important papers in the past and today. Well, if you look at the most important papers in the past, usually in the old days, it was one author from one discipline. The idea was still you could be like Newton, you were at Cambridge, you were at Queen's College, Cambridge, you had an apple falling on your head, or so the story goes, and you had a great idea, you publish it, everybody refers to it. And by the way, you know, as you might know, you can very easily quantify the importance of a paper through citations. Very similar to the likes on Facebook. Like many people like you, or many people cite you, use that as a measure of the impact. So the most impactful paper at the time were by one author from one discipline. But if you look at papers today, the most important ones are many, many authors from many different disciplines. And so it's a big fundamental change in the way we can advance knowledge. And I think that also applies to cities. And you know, that's really what we study. But you know, when you look at cities, this is the presentation in 1923 by Le Corbusier of the so-called Plan Voisin. It was in a pavilion called the Pavillon de l'Esprit Nouveau. I think it was in the month of October. And when you look at this, you see the hand of Le Corbusier presenting his plan for Paris. His plan for Paris, by the way, was quite simple. Was demolish the whole city, just keep Notre Dame and a couple of other little things for posterity, and replace everything with beautiful modernist skyscrapers. And if you look at this, if you look at the hand of Le Corbusier, which is the hand of the architect, but almost the hand of God, you know, that's really the maximum top-down vision of the city. Is one person alone making decisions for millions of people without even bothering to ask them. You know, at the time people say, you know, well, you cannot really design in a collaborative way. There's a motto in the United States says, you know, a camel is a horse designed by a committee. So, you know, if you put too many people together, you don't get a beautiful horse, you will get a camel. Well, again, we think that is changing. The same idea of collaboration is changing many different aspects. It's changing science, it's changing design, it's changing the way we think about cities, it's changing engineering. We're trying to look at some of this in a book that came out a couple of years ago we called Open Source Architecture. Really, how we can use the paradigm of sharing and open sourcing, also in the way we solve problems, the way we design something together. You know, that book actually came out of an op-ed I did for Domus. Domus is a design magazine, and they have an editorial at the beginning. And so they had an issue on open source architecture, and they asked me if I could write the editorial. And I say, sure, I'm very happy to write it. But you know what? If this is about open source, then maybe we should write it in a collaborative way. And so what we did, we went online on Wikipedia, and then invited a few friends, also Antoine Picon, who politely declined. He will tell us later why. And we started writing, you know, with Nicolas Negroponte, with Paolo Antonelli, with many other John Maider. We started working together on this text, and you know, that was the kernel at the beginning of the book. Actually, if you go on the Wikipedia site, you see that page now being modified thousands and thousands of times by people who constantly try to redefine what, you know, what a more collaborative approach to design and architecture could be. And I'll tell you, at the end, we had an issue, however. And the issue is that Domus, when they publish your op-ed, they also want to have a picture of whoever wrote the article. And I say, well, I'm not going to give you my picture, so how do we do this? And at the same time, they didn't have the space for putting everybody's picture over there. Usually put one page picture for who did the op-ed. And so we went back and forth for a while, and we couldn't find a solution. In the end, okay, I say, okay, fine, I'm going to give you a picture. And again, in this picture, which was a sum of all of us, you know, just in Photoshop. And I wanted to start to end with this image to have a wish. And the wish is that tomorrow's engineers, tomorrow's architects, will be a bit less like Le Corbusier, the guy who single-handedly can actually decide to demolish or propose to demolish the whole city of Paris and rebuild it according to his wish, even without bothering to ask people, to engage people in the process. A little bit more like this, like, you know, an engineer, an architect, a designer, an urbanist that puts together all of us. That was my first conclusion. I had a second conclusion I want to share with you, is that, you know, I think this is a great guy. He's a great guy. He's a guy who was also here at the school a couple of hundred years ago. He's Navier. You might know the Navier-Stokes equations. If you don't, you will discover them during Mecaflu. Mecaflu, I had plenty of fun when I had it here at the École des Ponts. You know, it's a beautiful mathematics applied to fluids. So you will see it. I saw before, it's still there, the same class. And so I think you will do it in around a year. He helped solve many, many engineering problems. But you need to pay attention with him. You need to pay attention because when you solve a problem in real life, it's not only taking Navier-Stokes equation or any other equation, applying them to reality. If you are an engineer, you actually need to be creative. You need to think about how that can help generate a new city, a new building, something new that wasn't there before. You know, that's my postscriptum. It's a sentence by Einstein, who once said, scientists investigate that which already is, and the engineers create that which has never been. And I think that's your task. So I think don't be shy about it. It's about, you know, it's not about just taking an equation and applying it to the world as it is. But actually, you can use that equation. You know, you've learned. If you're here, you've proven that you know how to handle those equations. But then you can use it in order to see how the world could be, how you can transform the places you live, or the space, or the environment, or our own planet. And so, you know, what is the final thing? Just, you know, with I was thinking about this is like your opening presentation, and, you know, something that what you'll see here today in the next few days, you know, the beginning of what you will do in the next 3 years. If I had to give you a recommendation, I was asked, actually, you know, so, you know, what would you recommend to them? A sentence came out of a movie. It's one of my favorite movies. It's a movie by Truffaut, it's Jules Le Jim. And in that movie, there's this line, and I want to finish with this. It's about Jim. And Jim says, mais alors, que dois-je devenir? Un curieux. Ce n'est pas un métier? Ce n'est pas encore un métier. Voyagez, écrivez, traduisez, apprenez à vivre partout. Commencez tout de suite. L'avenir est au curieux de profession. Merci.
Professor Atti, I deeply and warmly thank you for this fascinating conference, very stimulating for young students, future engineers, for all you showed about a combination of sophisticated modelizations, use of new technologies, analysis of the behavior of the citizens to build innovations. And well, your conclusions on your postscriptum. So many thanks for all that. And so now for the second part of this, your inaugural lecture, you proposed to associate Professor Antoine Picon to discuss together and with the public how the role of engineer is evolving today. So I would like to invite now Professor Picon to join us. Antoine Picon is an engineer, an architect, a doctor in history. He's a director of research at École des Ponts. He's a professor of architecture on technology at the Graduate School of Design in Harvard University. He's also a professor in École des Ponts, and he will teach you a course about technology, engineers, and society in the following weeks. Thank you, Antoine, to join us. And so I leave you to start this debate how this role of engineer is evolving today. Thank you.
Thank you. Merci.
Merci, François.
First thing I wanted to say is you know, this is more like a discussion. So I think, you know, it's really up to you to come up with questions, thoughts, ideas, and so on. But you know, and should we do in English, or do you want to try in French?
I think we may try. Why don't I speak French? Because actually, I'm much more fluent in French, if you don't mind, and since you understand French perfectly. And, you know, we can switch back and forth. On fait du franglais. Bon, on va faire ça un peu, c'est un peu à l'anglo-saxonne, c'est-à-dire les anglo-saxons adorent après les conférences des in conversation with. je vais peut-être faire quelques remarques et te poser quelques questions, et puis ensuite, dans l'espoir que vous allez ensuite sauter et avoir plein de questions après cette présentation passionnante. Moi, il y a un certain nombre de choses qui m'ont frappé. La première, c'est qu'il y a quand même plusieurs dimensions dans ton travail, une qui est quand même les maths. Tu es revenu plusieurs fois, c'est peut-être pour essayer de nous montrer que finalement tu es quand même un type sérieux, qui fait pas uniquement des roues de bicyclette et de l'affichage dans les supermarchés. Donc il y a quand même beaucoup de trucs sur les maths. Il y a une autre dimension qui m'a quand même intéressé, notamment par rapport à l'École des Ponts, parce que l'École des Ponts, bon, désolé pour vous les gars, mais c'est pas l'école normale supérieure, on fait pas que des maths, on fait de la méca, on fait de la physique, etc. Et je trouve que beaucoup de tes projets associent en fait une partie maths autour des big data, autour de etc. Une partie qui est quand même parfois très très méca et physique, de les roues de bicyclette, les bateaux avec etc. Donc ça, j'ai trouvé ça intéressant, ça. Et puis il y a une partie qu'on trouve pas toujours dans les écoles d'ingénieurs, mais qui se développe aujourd'hui, qui est autour de design. Finalement, faire du projet. J'avais un peu envie de t'interroger, un peu quelle est ta vision. Est-ce que l'École des Ponts, ça t'a préparé à ça, ou finalement c'est quelque chose qui vient complètement d'ailleurs? This triad, mathematics, physical science, mechanics, etc., and design.
Yeah. Just, you know, the technical terms are not better in English. I reply in English. First of all, I want to say that Antoine and I go back a long way. Actually, the...
Be personal.
When I joined the École des Ponts, I think it was the first year that Antoine was teaching, or one of the first years, the second year Antoine was teaching. And so all my colleagues came to me and said, you know, well, you need to take this class at the École des Ponts. It's really people. Everybody gets A. So I registered for his class. And we got good friends since then. So then he came to Harvard. And
I'm not sure he gave you an A, by the way.
you might go back and change it now after this. But I really thought it was a very interesting class. By the way, I think it's still offered now in a different way. Because it's about thinking about what is an engineer. And it's about how an engineer has been in the past, and you know, how it actually the profession might change tomorrow. And to me, the key thing, and that's something I understood more when I went to Cambridge, is the component I was saying before of design. Now, design in English is different than design in French. Design means conception. Is about, you know, thinking about putting something together. Design is what an projet is what an engineer does, is design. What an architect does is design. What an urbanist does is design. And design is crucial to engineering. Again, you know, if you look at what at the quote by Einstein, it's about looking at things that haven't been there. If you're interested in this mode, there's another great book I would recommend. It's a book by Herbert Simon. Herbert Simon was a Nobel Prize winner. He was also a researcher, an economist, a sociologist. Did a lot of very interesting mathematics as well. And Simon, you know, writes in this book called The Science of the Artificial. He writes, science looks at how the world is, design and how it ought to be. And I think, you know, that's the key thing. So when you look at that, yes, you know, going back to Antoine's question, yes, you need to know mathematics because that is a tool for solving something. But you always want to start from the design side. You always want to start from thinking about how things could be. And then maybe use mathematics in order to, you know, if you think about the paper I showed you about sharing taxes in New York, this was published in a journal, the Proceeding of the National Academy of Science, which is usually a journal where there's a lot of physics, interdisciplinary science, and so on. So it's a journal for a lot of science. But if you want that question, was a design question. For us, the question was, you know, think about New York. Well, how many trips could you share if you were to have the potential to do it? You know, if you take a certain delta, that's a design question. So somehow, for me, the design is always the beginning, is the question. And then, yes, you might want to use many different tools in order to solve it. So that's the answer I would give to your question.
Autre question gentille, mais un petit peu vacharde quand même. Je suis très frappé dans ce que tu as présenté. La première chose, c'est quand même l'importance de ce qu'on appelle souvent en anglais the vision, c'est-à-dire la vision, c'est-à-dire partir finalement, est-ce que c'est ce que tu as dit à la fin avec Einstein, imaginer que le monde puisse être différent. Et ça, je trouve que c'est peut-être quelque chose, je ne sais pas si l'éducation développe ça assez, je ne sais pas si ce n'est pas une question pour les grandes écoles aujourd'hui, c'est comment on apprend à voir différemment, à imaginer que les choses puissent être différentes. Il y a une autre dimension, alors ça c'est un peu la partie vacharde de la question, il y a un côté Barnum ou publicité ambulante dans ce que tu présentes avec tous ces petits films, etc. Ben alors c'est pas complètement vache parce que je pense que ça renvoie à une autre nécessité aujourd'hui pour innover qui est la nécessité de convaincre et finalement le fait qu'innover c'est peut-être parfois au moins moins 50% de communication. Et pour moi, c'est vraiment une question. Est-ce que, et vous avez, normalement, vous allez apprendre des outils pour communiquer, mais je trouve très, très frappant, finalement, dans ta démarche, à quel point ça associe la capacité de voir des choses différentes, par exemple, d'avoir cette idée un peu dingote de tes bateaux à Amsterdam. J'y crois pas une seconde, mais c'est quand même une idée assez sympa. Et puis, ce que je trouve toujours intéressant, derrière ça aussi, il y a eu deux termes dont tu as parlé, l'idée de prototype. Qui n'est pas quelque chose forcément, c'est comme les voitures prototypes, on ne les verra peut-être pas sur la route, mais on verra des choses qui en dérivent. Ouais. Et ça me paraît très important. Et dernier point dont je voulais parler, parce que ça, c'est le truc auquel on prépare le plus mal dans les grandes écoles, c'est la prise de risque. C'est-à-dire que c'est quand même, dont je dirais, vision, communication, une espèce de côté expérimental, prototype, etc. Et parfois, ça peut servir à rien. Et puis, enfin, la prise de risque. Ce qui est finalement complètement différent de la façon dont traditionnellement on structurait, je dirais, un peu la pensée de l'ingénieur, la figure de l'ingénieur. Donc je voulais un peu que tu réagisses à ça.
No, thanks. I actually think it's a very interesting question. And it's a very interesting question because I'll tell you, I need to tell you as well, and I think that's where the question.
No, you don't know Vacharde
is coming from. Antoine is also the president of the Fondation Le Corbusier. And if you look at Le Corbusier, the way of designing in the 20th century was really the idea that, you know, well, you got a solution, and you just impose it on people. You got a solution, and you just apply it. But it was, you know, I'm saying Le Corbusier, I singled out Le Corbusier to start a nicer conversation, but the same thing applies to most of what we've seen in the 20th century. It has been about, you know, having a solution, many times a very rational solution, we can prove it's good for society, and you just impose it on society. Well, I think the time is over. And the time is over because we actually know that there's never just an optimal solution across the spectrum. But actually, we got different type of parameters, and the balance between them is not something you can actually optimize for just one solution. You can actually something where you need to engage people in seeing how you want to go. And that's why I think that communications is very important. You know, I think it's not we're having fun maybe in doing the video. The important thing, yes, is the scientific, the science behind it. But then you want to communicate. And you want to communicate because I think that our role is different. Our role should not be the role of the 20th century engineer or architect, which is, you know, this is a solution, we just deploy it without even, you know, asking people if they like it or not. It's more about making proposal, about suggesting something. It is about, if you think, if you take an analogy with natural evolution, it's like looking at mutations and then letting society respond to those mutations. And that becomes a beautiful thing where, yes, communication is very important because many people need to respond to that. And, you know, sometimes, I'll tell you something even more, sometimes you want to show some mutation that will never, or you hope that they will never develop. Like if you think about the first project, like the project in Rome, the one we by looking at tracking of cell phones, we knew that was very interesting, you know, would open up a lot of research and a kind of a whole field of investigation. But at the same time, we thought it was also scary. It was the fact you could track anybody in society. And but then you want to show it, because by showing that, by exposing people to that, by starting a conversation, then, you know, you can develop antibodies in the system. And so even if you got something where you don't want to go, it's a little bit, for those of you who are familiar with hacking. You know, hacking originated at MIT a few decades ago, and, you know, this idea you can hack a system. But there's two types of hackers. There's white hat and black hat. And a white hat hacker is actually somebody who will take a system, show a vulnerability with a good purpose, the fact that, you know, the system could be fixed. So I would say that, you know, communication is very important because it's about showing people different ways in which the city could be, in which I say the city because it's what we study, but you can apply this to virtually any part of engineering, of architecture. And then you want to show that, and then, you know, let people then decide which way we want to go. The city of tomorrow is not what we decide. The city of tomorrow should be what together, collectively, all of us decide to be it to be.
Okay. Bon, je vais te poser une dernière question et puis ensuite on va passer évidemment la parole à la salle parce que je suis sûr que vous avez plein de réactions. Alors en t'écoutant, j'ai toujours, si tu veux, un mélange d'admiration et d'infini agacement. Alors, on va pas repartir sur nos questions habituelles parce qu'on on ergote souvent sur des questions autour des questions du déterminisme technologique, etc. Non, je voudrais te parler de politique. Parce que ce qui m'a rendu très nerveux tout au long de ton exposé... Alors, si, il y a quand même un truc qui m'a fait marrer après, avec tes carrefours, etc., et ta vision systémique de la ville, c'est quand la Rand Corporation a essayé de rationaliser les stations d'incendie à New York. Ça a été une catastrophe absolue, parce qu'évidemment, ils avaient fabriqué un magnifique système. Il y avait aussi quelques visualisations, etc. Ils avaient oublié les embouteillages à New York. Je dirais, le risque, quand même... Et je pensais à ça en voyant tes carrefours de véhicules, parce que... C'est absolument magnifique comme ça sur un computer screen, mais la réalité est tellement multidimensionnelle que je suis sûr qu'il y a quelque chose qui a été oublié, etc. Mais bon, c'est pas de ça dont je voulais parler. Ce dont je voulais parler, c'est l'espèce de nervosité que j'ai finalement par rapport au côté angélique du monde que tu nous décris. C'est-à-dire un monde open source, c'est merveilleux, etc. Mais en fait, open source, je te rappellerai quand même qu'à la fin, sur le livre, il n'y a que ton nom et celui de Matthew Claudel. Donc, en fait, c'est de l'open source quand même extrêmement top-down. Je dirais, tes projets, tu dis tout le temps « to empower people, to free people, initiative », etc. Mais tu dessines quand même des trucs qui, à la fin, sont quand même extrêmement contraignants en termes d'usage, etc. Donc, j'ai un peu l'impression quand même qu'il y a un côté « Brave New World ». Et là où ça a culminé pour moi, c'est l'histoire du voleur, et où dans laquelle, à la fin, tu nous confies « and the MIT police took over ». D'ailleurs, j'ai noté, il allait à Roxbury, non, ton voleur. Mm-hmm. C'est une impression. Bon, qui est le quartier black de Boston. Évidemment, tu as complètement... Si tu veux, il y a quand même une espèce d'élision dans tout ce que nous a présenté, des problèmes politiques, des problèmes raciaux, mm-hmm. des problèmes de liberté individuelle, etc., comme si tout allait baigner, comme si... Alors, ça m'a fait penser, du coup, d'ailleurs, à tout le discours, là aussi, complètement lignifiant, auquel on avait droit à propos des réseaux sociaux, qui allaient promouvoir les démocraties, etc., ce qu'écrivait Zuckerberg, jusqu'à ce qu'on découvre qu'en fait, ça a été un puissant moteur de renforcement des fractures politiques dans le cadre de l'élection américaine. Donc, je voulais un peu t'interroger finalement sur la politique, parce que tu en parles finalement jamais vraiment. Le monde est peuplé de maires bienveillants qui veulent faire des vélos participatifs, etc. But what about the tension and the war of the world? What about the violence in the world? What about, you know, even when you do things in Paris, you seem to completely oblivious of the huge tension they are right now in a city like Paris, as if, in a way, politics was actually, aren't you resurrecting the old technocratic dream?
No.
Which would be the worst kind of technocratic dream, because it would be in the name of every one of us.
I'll tell you why not, but it's a very important point. And I think it's a very important point because, you know, ultimately, you know, this decision is a political decision. However, if you look at the engineering and architecture in the past century, it was usually, you know, something was reporting to politics. And yes, you could decide, I'm not going to work in this condition or not, but it was pretty much the only choice you had. But it was actually subservient to politics. And if you think about this as what we can do is actually look at possible universe, possible wars, possible artifacts that they can be created. If what we collectively do is actually look at different ways to, say, transform our cities, then that's the beginning. It's not the end of the political spectrum, the conversation. So I think the reason is that I think perhaps if you look at this in a 20th century paradigm, yes, you know, there's a missing piece. But if you look at this as the beginning, where you say, I'm not saying that we should do crossings like the one I showed. I'm saying, you know, that's a possibility, but there should be a conversation. And actually, if you look at the website, there's a lot of points about, yes, you can integrate pedestrians. Is this good? Should you just, you know, think about actually a way where cars would be much less, have much less prominence than what they have in there? So there's many open questions there. But those questions, they're not a simple optimization. They get, as you said, multi-dimensions. And the only way we can do it is by starting the conversation. So what I see is that the political process was what has to start after this. And I realized that I didn't answer totally the previous question when one important point you mentioned about the prototype. So if you make something concrete, then we can all respond in a much better way. So somehow what I'm saying, what I'm advocating is almost, you know, look at how we can introduce mutations. We can introduce mutations in the artificial world, in our cities, in our buildings, in the things that we'll design as engineers, you know, when you get out of the school. And then you introduce mutations. But then if you do, you want to do it in a way that, you know, you do a prototype, you show it, you communicate, you tell, you let people play with it. And then if that thing is success, it might become something. If not, it might die. But that's where the politics has to enter. And if you do this, then you can play, you almost need to separate your two components. One is you as a mutagen, you know, creating the mutation. And the second one is actually how you can force society, how you can
yourself. How you can force society.
No. I'm saying it's the opposite. How you can force a response from society. So how you can make sure that there is a feedback loop so that that starts the political process. But what I'm saying is that you need to separate the mutation itself, and sometimes, as I said, the mutation should go in the opposite direction of what you want to, where you think that the actual society might go, just in order to create the antibodies, just in order to allow, as we were saying before, a white hacking approach.
Okay, I'll just make a final comment and then we'll open to the floor, which means here, the public. I'm not convinced. Let me tell you why. Because I think you tend to separate technological design, the design of a prototype of whatever, from social processes. And then you say, you know, I put this object in the social realm, and then society adapts. But what if, actually, you had to really co-construct
the technological system with the social dynamism. And this is not what you're doing. You're actually remaining external. But I think it's perhaps time to move to the floor. So,
yeah, any...
C'est le moment où jamais de poser des questions à Carlo.
Poser des questions en français ou en anglais, yes. What? Yes, go ahead. It's a good question. Well, you saw, I have an Apple computer. I think you know, if you look at some of the things we were discussing before, I think there have been incredible innovations coming out of the company. If you think about something like, I left it there, but you know, what smartphones did to us is radically create a whole new way of living and doing things. You wouldn't have Uber or Airbnb or many other things if you didn't have smartphones. You wouldn't have navigation as we have it today. And all of that happened in 10 years. So I think that's a clear example of what Antoine was saying, or what we, Antoine and I were discussing, you know, how you start from a mutation. That mutation in that case actually generated a whole ecosystem, society started responding, and that became the beginning of a big transformational force. So I think, you know, we've seen coming from there a few different similar mutations. My impression is that that's not happening anymore. So it has become more like an established producer of things. And, you know, like it happened with others, might be swept away if it doesn't innovate. I haven't seen any new innovation in recent years. But I think if you look at the past, certainly has transformed the lives of billions of people. And I think that that has been really good.
Vous insistez beaucoup sur l'importance de donner, enfin de demander l'avis aux consommateurs vis-à-vis des produits. On lui demande. Mais pour moi, la communication vis-à-vis des consommateurs est un problème dont vous n'avez pas forcément parlé, puisque aujourd'hui, je vois deux solutions pour leur demander leur avis. Ou, c'est la manière démocratique, on demande aux politiques. Nous l'avons vu en France ou en Islande, il y a eu des référendums qui n'ont pas été respectés. Ou alors, on fait, c'est ce que j'ai vu au travers de votre exposé, des collections de données qui ne sont pas forcément voulues, puisque j'ai l'impression que c'est quand même des données qui sont faites à l'insu des consommateurs, vis-à-vis notamment d'une surveillance sur leur téléphone. Donc, j'aimerais savoir comment vous voyez la communication, quelles sont les manières que... comment vous voyez la communication entre donc, les consommateurs.
Yeah. Well, I would say a couple of things. I wouldn't say usually there's no consumer. I mean, if you think about it, again, you know, you can look at... Maybe the supermarket is an exception in the way that that was also a place to buy things. But usually it's not a consumer. If you want, there is a citizen, somebody living in a city, and you can show a potential for transforming something. And maybe, you know, there's other projects which show it more. But if you think about, you know, the project with taxis in New York, you just, you know, look at something, analyze it mathematically, and see that you could actually design a different system, start from a design question, and see that, you know, the design question has a possible solution. Then you just want to expose people to that. So I think there's no consumer. Nobody's going to buy that. Most of the things, the only things that went into product has been much later in the process. You know, even the Copenhagen wheel at the beginning was just a prototype. You want to show people, you know, wait, look, wouldn't it be cool? You take this element, you turn your bike into a superbike. And so you're not talking to consumers. They're talking to citizens or other people. And I think what you want to do is again, show potential developments. In many cases, yes, also things that are totally dystopian. So you want to look at how data could be used for good, or how data, like a white hat hacker would do, how data could also be used for other things. So somehow, again, it goes back to the same conversation before, is about how you can get all of this you know, use it as a way to start a conversation. And that conversation, you know, can start from one direction or the other direction, but the important thing is that you start from a mutation and that's in look at response from society. So again, you don't think about a consumer because in all of the projects, there's never a consumer. The only cases when there has been a consumer happen much later when, you know, like the Copenhagen wheel was an idea, was a prototype, and then, you know, it became much, much later like a company and in our product.
Semble un peu dédié aux villes du Nord, aux capitales de pays plutôt développés, mais comment est-ce que vous assurez de faire participer aussi des acteurs de pays émergents.
It's a great question and thanks for asking it. Every technology has to start somewhere. And usually, by definition, every technology starts at the cutting edge. So if you think about a smartphone, if you think about this thing, when it started 20, 30 years ago, this was super expensive, and just the elite could actually own a smartphone, or own a phone, a cell phone. Maybe it's better probably if you turn off the mic, is at the bottom. So at the beginning, that was really something that only a few people could own, and it was actually increasing the divide, not decreasing the divide. But then, yeah, so every technology has to start somewhere. And usually, as I was saying, is at the cutting edge. So if you think about something like this at the beginning, this was very expensive. It was increasing the divide, not decreasing the divide. But then you fast forward, 10, 20, 30 years. Now you see amazing things where actually smartphones or cell phones in general are closing the divide. You see, we've seen in Sri Lanka fishermen using real-time information through cell phone in order not to be ripped off anymore by people buying the fish because they know in real time what the price is. We've seen what's happening in Africa where actually cell phones are being used to an extent that you cannot imagine, for instance, for banking. Mobile banking in Europe and in the US is nothing compared to what's happening over there, which is much more advanced, has been leapfrogging ways ahead of many other societies. So what I'm saying, every piece of technology at the beginning will just have an impact on few people and will increase the divide. But then if you plan the transition well, and if you actually look at the way it can trickle down, then later this can have the other effect. It can actually help leapfrog, and it can actually do exactly the opposite of what we were saying.
Sauf que Carlo, si tu regardes, par exemple, ça c'est le schéma, c'est précisément ce que je te reproche parfois, ça c'est le schéma angélique. Mais si tu regardes la révolution industrielle, par exemple, le coton se développe, effectivement, il y a des machines à Manchester, etc. Et en même temps, se développe l'esclavage aux États-Unis pour fournir les machines de coton de Manchester. Il y a un très bon bouquin par un professeur d'Harvard, évidemment, pas d'MIT, sur le sujet. Moi, je pense que c'est quand même un peu une vision angélique, se dire ça démarre chez les riches et ça se diffuse, etc. Parce que ce qui se crée souvent avec les technologies, c'est des gradients sociaux et politiques terribles. Et tu prends l'histoire de l'esclavage moderne, elle est dans une large mesure, elle s'intensifie au début du 19e siècle à cause du passage de la canne à sucre au coton. Et en fait, tu te rends compte qu'en fait, un système technique extrêmement sophistiqué dans certaines parties du monde va de pair avec un système d'exploitation. Tu peux te demander d'ailleurs, parce qu'effectivement, le smartphone se diffuse, on en trouve maintenant, c'est vrai, ce que tu dis, dans les bidonvilles d'Inde, etc. Mais d'un autre côté, tu as montré toi-même les gens qui font du e-waste, et puis il y a les conditions de travail de Foxconn en Chine, etc. Donc est-ce que finalement ce modèle de la diffusion dans laquelle on va tous vers le paradis, on n'assiste pas en fait à la recréation de violences sociales?
I think you might be right, but the no, you may be right. It's every technology. I'm not saying the technology will certainly go in the right direction. I'm saying the question was a different question. The question was, where, we've been looking at things that can actually help in the developed world. And the question is, are they going to help in other parts of the world? And my answer is yes, if you play it right, technologies can trickle down. And there's many examples that start in one place and go there. Now, your question is much more profound. It's about, every technology has always a dark side. And I'm not saying the technology is going to have just a positive impact. Never said that. I just said, if you look at this, you can start at the cutting edge, and then you can have an impact, say, in emerging countries and other parts of the world we didn't think at the beginning. Now, what that impact is, however, is something else, and that's part of the political discussion we need to have. So again, the example you gave are examples where the politics fail.
Parce que, qu'on soit clair, je suis pas un technophobe, sinon je serais pas ici. Mais je pense qu'il faut parfois intérioriser la dimension politique, y compris au niveau de la conception de la technologie.
Je me demandais, à vous entendre, c'est le métier d'ingénieur devient plus un semeur de graines où on donne des idées un peu par là, les voitures intelligentes, les voitures volantes comme Airbus, au style le cinquième élément de Luc Besson. Mais est-ce que en fait le métier d'ingénieur c'est vraiment créer quelque chose pour l'appliquer, ou maintenant c'est on donne des idées et puis on voit si ça marche ou si la société veut bien en entendre parler ou pas?
Good question. Let's hear the three questions and then we respond to all of them.
Moi, c'est une question un peu plus d'ordre social. C'est avec notamment le marché un peu intelligent où on voit d'où viennent les produits. Mais moi, ce que je me pose comme question, c'est est-ce que vraiment les gens, quand ils vont au supermarché, ça les intéresse? Est-ce qu'ils veulent de l'information? Et du coup, est-ce que c'est vraiment utile dans le sens les personnes viennent juste au supermarché faire leurs courses et prennent ce qui leur convient et se fichent un peu? Enfin, c'est aussi au niveau des déchets. Je ne pense pas qu'il y ait un grand ensemble de populations qui se demandent où vont mes déchets et qu'est-ce qu'on en fait et comment on optimise la chose. Donc, c'est la question de l'intérêt des personnes en général par rapport à ça.
Cool. So maybe we just I think they go well actually in reverse order. So for starting with your question first, yes, you're totally right. You know, there's energy that goes just in maintaining the system, but the amount of energy you can save if you can play it right can be much, much more. So for instance, let me tell you, I didn't show it today, but we did a lot of work on energy systems in buildings. In most buildings, including I think this building that was built 20 years ago. For instance, do heating and cooling everywhere without responding to people. Now in a moment we'll go out for lunch, and then this room will still be cooled.
Let me reassure you, cooling here does not really exist.
No, I think, you know, there is air conditioning. I guess, you know, today is very hot outside. No, air conditioning or heating. You think about the winter time, you know, then we'll go out for lunch and this will still be heated all the time. If you look at that, that per se means that probably we waste 50% of the energy in buildings. It depends about the occupancy rate, just because we heat them all the time. Or think about our homes during the winter. We are at work, and we keep on heating them. And so for instance, we just opened a building a couple of weeks ago. What we did, we added the technology to sense presence, and through that, be able to just put energy where people are. Actually, almost do like a bubble of heat that follows you as you move through the building. Now, if you do that, of course, you're using a little bit of energy in order to run the internet in the building, use a little bit of energy for the sensors and for the computers analyzing all of this. But if you make the calculations, you see that that is kind of less than 3% than what you can save by making the building more efficient. So I'm not saying that this is always the rule. Yes, we are wasting more and more energy into digital systems. But at the same time, in many cases, we can use this in order to run better a car, a building, a city. And what you can save there is actually much more than what you use. Think about the following. Many of you will be actually in the construction industry if you take especially Génie Civil at the Ecole, then, you know, just the buildings overall, in this country, in the UK, they use around 50% of all the energy consumed by the country. That's about, you know, all the construction, the operations, and so on. And so if you can change a little bit of that, it's going to more than offset what you might need to use into the internet system. Now, going back to the second question, that was about people, you know, are we really sure that people want to have information? Well, I have no clue. But the only way we can find out if we do a project and we see how it goes. And it goes back to the same thing. It's good to fail. Don't be scared about failing. You know, we're just going to try something and then see how people respond. And so in the case of what we saw in Milan, we saw that, yes, you know, well, first of all, we made it backward compatible so that if you go to the supermarket, you could get things in 1 second, like you would get today. But if you wanted, you could actually play for 3 seconds and learn a little bit, or play more and learn a little bit more. And so, you know, by doing that, we saw that actually people were quite interested in that. And I think, you know, the reason, the explanation I give is that today, if you go online, you find a lot of information about the things we buy. But that information is usually not available in the real world. So finding ways to bridge it actually is something we like. But I had no clue if this would be a success or a failure until when, you know, we tried it. And that's why I think it's important to, first of all, you know, keep in mind that, you know, you need to be ready to fail. And by failing, you will learn something. And then the next time, you will do better. And I will let Antoine answer first, and then, you know, I'll tell you my take. But I think I would like Antoine to say first, you know, here's the world leader in thought leader in looking at, you know, the engineer today and how it might change. So I will let you have a stab first.
Je crois que tu es quand même un ingénieur assez particulier, il faut quand même le dire. Mais moi, ce que je retiendrai quand même, je trouve que ce qui est intéressant, c'est qu'il y a un certain nombre de choses que tu as dites qui me semblent vraiment extrêmement importantes et s'appliquent à tous les métiers d'ingénieur aujourd'hui. Un, quand même, l'idée que le monde... Je crois qu'on a beaucoup habitué les ingénieurs à se dire, finalement, le monde était déjà là, etc. En fait, non, le monde n'est pas déjà là, il va changer énormément, même entre le moment où vous êtes rentré à l'école, le moment où vous êtes sorti. Et finalement, participer à l'invention du monde, ça me semble une leçon. Une autre leçon que j'ai trouvée absolument essentielle dans ce que tu as dit, c'est oui, il ne faut pas avoir peur de l'échec. Dans un système qui, depuis le départ, vous a habitué plutôt à l'inverse, oh là là, j'ai raté les mines, ou oh là là, j'ai raté, mais j'ai quand même eu les ponts. Et non, ça, forget about it. L'avenir commence maintenant et il commence par, finalement, je dirais, prendre des risques, se dire qu'on va peut-être se planter des fois et qu'à la fin... On va gagner parce qu'on a pris des risques. Ça me semble aussi quand même quelque chose d'assez universalisable. Je trouve qu'en ce sens-là, on va pas tous faire le genre de choses que tu fais avec l'infrastructure que tu as et avec cette trajectoire quand même tout à fait en norme. Mais en tout cas, je crois qu'il y a un certain nombre, et c'est, je crois, le sens de cette conférence inaugurale, je crois qu'il y a un certain nombre de choses qui d'ailleurs font écho à ce qui a été dit avant par Gilles Robin, Marie et d'autres. Par exemple, il va falloir de plus en plus apprendre à innover, qu'on le veuille ou non. On n'a pas le choix. Moi, j'appartenais encore à des générations dans lesquelles, grosso modo, l'ingénieur des ponts, c'était un gars, on prenait le jeune ingénieur des ponts, on le mettait sur des rails, et telle la locomotive, il était censé avancer. C'est plus le cas, il n'y a plus de rails. Il va falloir tracer son chemin comme une voiture autonome. Je crois qu'il y a ces choses-là à retenir. Oh, I know I let you have the concluding word, but let me thank you again for a wonderful lecture.
Thank you, Antoine, but I'll say, you know, we need to be careful because your point says, you know, are we going, you know, in among all these things, you're certainly also going to see a few crazy things. And if you look at how the innovation ecosystem works, you know, the innovation ecosystem traditionally, let me maybe this is a good way to, if you look at the traditional innovation ecosystem, something like next to Boston, this was called Route 128, the Silicon Valley. If you look at those places, you've got a lot of ideas that will transform the world, but also a lot of bullshit, a lot of crap. And so your point was about, you know, can we tell the difference? Well, I think somehow it's healthy that the system will have both of them. And something that actually become a startup, it has a lot of impact. Something else at the beginning looks like lunatic, might actually turn to do something different that nobody expected. You cannot be so deterministic. You mentioned before, my personal view is that we are not going to see many of the Airbus little pods that are like big drones in cities. And the reason for that is what I was saying before, is that they use a lot of energy just to stay over there, produce a lot of noise. I'll give you just an example, maybe just to look at this. If you are in New York, there's a place where helicopters take off in lower Manhattan. And in that place, you've got a few tens of takeoffs every hour. And because of that, that area is almost off limits because of the noise and all of the nuisance by helicopters. Now, we're talking about probably a few hundreds per day. I don't know the exact numbers. Now, if you wanted to have an impact on New York's traffic, you need to multiply that by 1,000 or by 1 million. You know, you need to get, you know, to 100,000 of takeoffs every day. You know, that would be totally impossible. So I don't think, for instance, that project by Airbus about, you know, flying cars will change mobility in cities, but might have other applications we never thought about. You know, might have great applications in Africa where you don't have infrastructure, might have great applications for, you know, for emergency, for ambulances in parts of the world where you don't have roads. Drones can still have a lot of impact, even if it's probably not what some people are thinking about tomorrow. Everybody in Paris is going to move with a little flying pod. So I think you want to be more tolerant. You want to, again, you know, take into account the fact that many things might fail, but some of them, you know, some might be have a huge impact. And if you look at the career of many people who have been working in the innovation space, you know, sometimes they failed. I believe that Travis, before Uber, failed once, and then Uber was a big success. Now, again, they're having some trouble. So you want to build that into the system. And to do it, you need to tolerate also ideas that might be a bit lunatic, and they might turn into something or may not. And, you know, if they don't make sense, they will disappear on their own. And that brings me really to what Antoine was saying about failure. Yes, you know, the French system traditionally, and I went through it, so the tradition has been against failure. And in Europe here, so you haven't failed, but every system has to build in some of it. First of all, because there's a lot of amazing people who maybe didn't make it here or didn't make it to some of the other top schools for whatever reason. And, you know, that actually, they could be Nobel Prize winners tomorrow, but they fail for some reason. You want to build the possibility to getting back into the system, to do rattrapage. And so I think, you know, there's something we need to build. We need to build a more flexible system that allows ideas to keep on being generated and to keep on bubbling up and tolerate things that might happen and then fail. And the good news for me is that thinking that in the past, you know, was confined to some areas of the world is now spreading very rapidly. I think the fact that ideas move faster with the internet, that people move much faster, you know, you're here in Paris today, you might live in another European or world city tomorrow, that capital moves faster to fund ideas, or you can just go on a crowdfunding platform and get the capital. Because of that, it's been quite amazing what we saw in the past 5 years. You know, London has created all of the Silicon Roundabout area from scratch. Berlin is one of the tech capitals today for innovation. There's many unicorns being developed there. I think Paris is doing very exciting things. Zaviniel and many of the other people are really, I believe, they're really transforming some of the innovation landscape in this city. And so I think, you know, for the first time, if we play it right, I think we got a great opportunity to look at, going back to the initial words before, about what did you say in French? You know, but the, how we could transform today into a different future.
Thank you, Carlo. Thank you.
Voilà bien, Carlo Ratti, Antoine Picon. Je vous remercie de nouveau tous les deux très chaleureusement pour Carlo pour avoir accepté cette invitation à la leçon inaugurale, Antoine Picon pour l'avoir suggéré, pour en avoir été à l'initiative. Je pense que c'était une très belle leçon pour nos jeunes élèves qui entrent à l'école des ponts. Donc merci encore.